It's Wednesday, March 12, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 continues to raise a host of very urgent questions. The questions are most urgent, of course, for those who had loved ones on the plane. But they are also urgent for many governments around the world, including especially the governments of China and Malaysia and the United States of America. Most of the passengers on the plane were from China or Taiwan. The airline was, of course, Malaysian Airlines. And the United States of America is very much engaged in this issue, not only because of the size of our Navy and other military resources in that area, but also because the airliner in question was a Boeing 777, a massive and heretofore very safe airliner produced by Boeing, a major American manufacturer. But the biggest questions that are raised here have to do with things that are now troubling us tremendously. The question of why, of course, but also the question of how. How could a massive airliner, a Boeing 777, that had been in sustained contact with radio during many points in its very short voyage, simply disappear? How can it now be missing several days after it did not show up at its destination and simply disappeared from radar screens? The answer is that there are many things we don't know, including the limitations of some of these technologies. We've come to assume that these technologies are accessible and working virtually all the time. We assume that our GPS can locate ourselves and our loved ones at virtually any time in any place on the planet. And yet, that isn't the case. It is made profoundly clear in this case that you can lose a giant airliner. As Wall Street Journal reporters Daniel Michaels and John Ostrower report, at least 80 airplanes are missing in terms of the history of international aviation. They include the fact that 11 years ago, a massive Boeing 727 airliner took off from Luanda, Angola, and has never been seen since. In 1979, a Boeing 707 with six people aboard was lost in the Pacific after leaving Tokyo. It's never been seen since. So far, as the reporters indicate, the fruitless search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 is particularly unprecedented, however, because of the plane's size and because of the nature of the radio contacts that the airliner had when it was flying until it was lost. They also point out the fact that the airliner was flying over one of the most densely populated regions of the Earth, Southeast Asia. It wasn't flying over remote jungle or over open ocean, but the airliner has disappeared nonetheless. In this respect, the headline in the Wall Street Journal article this morning says it all. Quote, "The Malaysia Airlines disappearance shows technology's limits," end quote. Indeed, it does. It also serves as a very stark reminder that technology cannot be relied upon in all situations, even though we often do just as a modern reflex. Technology cannot deliver us. The Christian worldview would remind us of that. Our technology is, after all, man-made. And as it is fabricated by humans, engineered and designed by human beings, fallible and frail as we are, our technology eventually will show all the fallibilities of our own human nature. But as the New York Times also reported yesterday, this particular incident shows other limitations in human nature. As Eric Schmidt reports, "As an armada of ships, planes, and helicopters combed the water south of Vietnam on Monday for any sign of a missing Malaysian airliner, aviation safety experts said the discovery that two passengers aboard the plane were traveling on stolen passports has revealed a major gap in airline security procedures developed since the attacks of September 11, 2001. Schmidt's article is very long. It's a very good investigative report, but there are two particular paragraphs that are of crucial importance. He writes, "Since Interpol created a database of stolen and lost passports in 2002, the international repository has grown to more than 40 million documents available for governments to screen for terrorists, smugglers, or swindlers who travel the world illicitly. But according to the International Law Enforcement Agency, only three countries, the United States, Britain, and the United Arab Emirates, systematically screen travelers against the agency's database of stolen passports." Schmidt also reports the two men with stolen passports who boarded the missing Malaysia Airlines flight from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to Beijing did not have their passports screened. End quote. So, what we have in this report from the New York Times and Eric Schmidt is the fact that another human problem revealed in this incident, even just on the basis of what we know now, is the human beings weren't even using the information available to them, information that was known to be strategic and important, even in something as volatile and fragile as the world of international aviation. They did not check the database. They could have, and even though it's not known at this point that these two men traveling on stolen passports had anything to do with the plane's disappearance, they certainly could have, and it demonstrates a vulnerability that, by the way, is now announced and broadcast to the entire watching world, including terrorists, by the New York Times. That's another factor of our age. When you ask these questions and answer them in public, the information is then loose for everyone in the world to see and to use, even to evil ends. But by the way, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and other major newspapers yesterday also had another very interesting story on their front pages. This had to do with the recall by General Motors of over 1 million vehicles suspected to have faulty ignition switches, leading to at least 13 documented deaths. Wall Street Journal reporter Jeff Bennett reports General Motors Company moved Monday to confront mounting questions over why it took nearly a decade to recall 1.6 million vehicles for faulty ignitions linked to 13 deaths. The key issue in that paragraph from our consideration is the fact that it took nearly a decade to recall the vehicles. Now, in 2004, it is reported by the Journal that GM employees knew about the defect. In 2007, it's clear that the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration also had at least some staff members who knew about the problem and documented it in a meeting of the agency in March of that year. That's 2007. So GM knew about it in 2004. The federal agency responsible for vehicle safety knew about it in 2007. 13 deaths took place since the problem arose, and no one did anything until just recently. Why? Once again, we have evidence of the impact of the fall on the way human beings think. Theologians refer to these as the noetic effects of the fall. The fall explains why we do not think rationally, why we often do not deal rationally with the information and facts put before us, why we sometimes prefer unreality to reality, why we have faulty memory, why we sometimes fail to connect the dots. And why, as these two news stories in tandem demonstrate, we simply do not deal with information that is put right before our eyes. In the case of the fact that these passports were not checked, even though the information was accessible, in the fact that going back to 2004 and 2007, people knew that the ignition switches were faulty and could lead to accidents and yet did nothing. From the perspective of the biblical worldview, this just demonstrates the fact that human beings show the fallenness of our state in our intelligence, and sometimes our lack of right working intelligence. We're often unable or unwilling to deal with the truth. We would prefer untruth to the reality that is right before us. And we would sometimes just like to forget what we know because the knowledge is simply too painful or complex or troubling for us. We'd rather just put it aside. That's evidently what some did back in 2004 and 2007 with information that could potentially have saved lives. That's what we now know took place in Malaysia, where officials simply didn't check the information that was accessible to them. Furthermore, as that news story demonstrated, only three nations in the world, the United States, Great Britain, and the United Arab Emirates, are actually using that information even now. Perhaps you remember that hymn that describes humanity as frail creatures of dust and feeble as frail. It turns out that not only our bodies are frail and feeble, but sometimes our thinking too. And that too is evidence of the fall and of our need for redemption. And speaking of technology, earlier this week a very important research report came out, published in the journal Pediatrics. The title is this: Patterns of Mobile Device Use by Caregivers and Children During Meals in Fast Food Restaurants, end quote. That might not sound like such a revealing article, but once you look at it, it truly is. It tells us something very important about the interface of technology and human life and how it affects families, mealtimes, and children. The researchers sent trained investigators into fast food restaurants trained to watch the interaction between adults and children eating meals. And they were watching for the impact of digital devices in terms of the interaction between the adults and children, assumed in most cases to be parents and children. And as it turned out, the digital devices used by parents or adults turned out to have a major issue in terms of blocking interaction with the children involved at the same table in the meal. Reading right from the report in Pediatrics, quote, 40 caregivers use devices during their meal. The dominant theme salient to mobile device use and caregiver-child interaction was the degree of absorption in devices caregivers exhibited. Absorption was conceptualized as the extent to which primary engagement was with the device rather than the child, and was determined by frequency, duration, and modality of device use. Child response to caregiver use, which ranged from entertaining themselves to escalating bids for attention, and how caregivers manage this behavior, and separate versus shared use of devices. Highly absorbed caregivers often responded harshly to child misbehavior. End quote. That's academic jargon for a very important point that we need to see clearly, and that is this. These investigators found that in almost every case where a digital device was present and visible during the meal, the adult or parent gave attention to the digital device to the frustration of children and to the absence or impairment of direct conversational interaction between the parent and the child. And as these pediatricians noted, that is a major problem for children who are already suffering in so many cases from inadequate interaction and conversation with the important adults, most importantly the parents, in their lives. A report on the research in Medical Daily cited Dr. Jenny Radesky, a fellow in developmental behavioral pediatrics at Boston Medical Center. She said, quote, we know from decades of research that face-to-face interactions are important for cognitive, language, and emotional development. Before mobile devices existed, mealtime would have been a time when we would have seen those interactions, end quote. In other words, here you have a pediatrician saying that the mealtime would have been the time when most adults and children had natural conversational interactions, but the mobile devices have shown up to interrupt that process. Medical Daily continued to report, quote, studies have shown that kids learn best through live interactions with their parents and other adults. One study found that interaction, even through video chat applications, were better than educational videos at teaching kids language and its mechanics with regards to conversation. Another study found that fathers who interacted with their children put them at lesser risk of behavioral problems later on. Being on a cell phone takes away a lot of time that should be better spent, especially because children tend to have inquiring minds, end quote. Indeed, when you look at the research, you'll discover that what the investigators observed was that parents were often irritated when their children tried to engage them in conversation at mealtime, interrupting the parents' engagement with the digital device. Many of these parents couldn't tear themselves away for even a few moments of conversation. When children began to try to get a parent's attention, the parents often became very frustrated and indeed sometimes responded even harshly to the children who were actually acting up in order to get the parent's attention to distract the parent from the digital device. Writing on the research in the pages of the New York Times, pediatrician Perry Kloss said, quote, children of all ages, 2, 15, 18, 22, use the same phrases to talk about how hard it is for them to get their parents' attention when they need it. Sad, angry, mad, frustrated. They were complaining that their parents were focused on screens, said the doctor. Talking about this new sibling rivalry, only it's not a new member of the family, it's a new screen, it's a device. End quote. That's a very interesting metaphor. These pediatricians are suggesting that these children are looking at these digital devices as competitors for a parent's attention. But it's not a brother or a sister. It's a digital device. And there's something deeply troubling about this, even as I imagine many parents recognize themselves in this research. In that sense, this might be a very healthy wake-up call for many parents to recognize that the digital device, smartphone or otherwise, can get in the way of the kind of engagement and interaction they want with their own children. By the way, one additional footnote to this research, adolescents, teenagers, and young adults were complaining that their parents were spending too much time on digital devices, time that was needed by the child to get the parent's attention for the kind of interaction the child urgently felt the need of at the time. There's something not only tragic about that, there's something that shows the inversion that has now been brought about by the ubiquity, that is, the nearly universal application and availability of this digital technology. It makes demands on us. Jacques Ellul, that great Protestant observer of technology, pointed out that every technology arrives making promises but ends up making demands. That's a very good thing for us to remember in this fallen world. We think of all these technologies as offering us so much promise. We often fail to see how they exercise such demands. And furthermore, as this report in the journal Pediatrics makes clear, the impact and cost of those demands on our own children. At my website at albertmoeller.com, I reposted an article I wrote several years ago that was requested, and in light of that request, I republished it at my website. It's entitled, From Father to Son, J.R.R. Tolkien on Sex. Many people think of Tolkien as that great classical writer of fantasy in the 20th century. Imbued with a Christian worldview and communicating it in the most marvelous terms through The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings series, and many other writings as well. Many Christians have found a very interesting grounding of their understanding of the Christian worldview in Middle Earth, revealing those deep biblical truths about morality, right and wrong, truth, courage, valiance, and so many other values that the literary works of Tolkien made so clear. But many people are unaware that Tolkien was also a parent. And as a parent, he wrote letters. And one of those letters I came across years ago was one written in 1941 to his son Michael, born in 1920. In other words, to a 21-year-old son. And it had to do with sex. In this letter, written to his 21-year-old son, Tolkien wrote this, quote, "This is a fallen world. The dislocation of sex instinct is one of the chief symptoms of the fall. The world has been going to the bad all down the ages. The various social forms shift, and each new mode has its special dangers. But," he wrote, "the hard spirit of concupiscence has walked down every street and sat leering in every house since Adam fell," end quote. What an incredibly revealing sentence. What a very profoundly true sentence. That spirit, that hard spirit of concupiscence, that is, of sexual sin and lust and all of its associated sins, has indeed walked down every street and sat leering in every house since Adam fell. Writing to his son, he went on to warn, and I quote, "The devil is endlessly ingenious, and sex is his favorite subject. He is as good every bit at catching you through generous, romantic, or tender motives as through baser or more animal ones," end quote. That, too, shows profound biblical and theological insight. Tolkien wrote to his son that the devil could use even romantic love in order to twist it into lust and to make something beautiful ugly. And as he says, in a way that should be memorable to each one of us, the devil is endlessly ingenious, and sex is his favorite subject. Tolkien wrote to his oldest son in 1941 as Europe was engaged in World War II, and all the horrors of that war were all about them. Tolkien wrote to his son knowing that his son just might face the kind of enemy represented by Nazi Germany, and might indeed face other enemies as well, enemies more subtle. Those enemies included all that Satan brings forth in terms of the temptations of the flesh, and especially, as he said, with sex as his favorite subject. Tolkien wrote to Michael that he needed to be very aware of the dangers of the male sex drive, and that sex drive in a fallen world. But he also wrote about the wonder of marriage and the fact that God had created marriage for a man and a woman to demonstrate his glory and to give his human creatures such a wonderful gift. This father wanted his son to direct his sexual interest and energies and hopes into faithful marriage, not just away from concupiscence. The other thing that Tolkien was very much aware of was the fact that in this fallen world, even as good things can be turned ugly, it was very important that he arm his sons for the worldview battle they were already facing. Writing to Christopher, his younger son, he explained the problems of this fallen world well. Quote, "We were born in a dark age, out of due time for us, but there is this comfort. Otherwise, we should not know or so much love what we do love. I imagine the fish out of water is the only fish to have an inkling of water," end quote. In other words, Tolkien said to his son, "We were born in a dark age out of due time. We did not choose our times, and we live in fallen times." That must have been especially excruciatingly clear in the year 1941 in Britain. But he wrote to his two sons with hope for the future, and with hope for those two sons. And he wrote to them with remarkable candor. That letter, written in 1941 to a 21-year-old son, his son Michael, should resound through the ages, not only to other fathers and sons, but to everyone who cares about the fate of marriage and sexuality in this fallen world. You'll find my article on J.R.R. Tolkien and the letter he wrote to his son about sex at albertmoeller.com. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. Remember, Ask Anything Weekend Edition, call with your question at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. Call with your question in your voice. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/AlbertMoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Orlando, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.